I spent from April 2016 to summer of last year not living on farms but staying on farms, four different farms around England and Wales, for a few days at least every season, commissioned to write about pasture farming and the landscape and man's relationship with the landscape and with the animals that form shape the landscape. Being a poet and of a slightly impractical bent, it took me a little while to get into it. And, you know, I spent 6 months absorbing information, taking notes, taking photographs, wandering around whilst the farmer said, "Why isn't he writing anything?" Kind of expecting things to grow more quickly. Which leads me to I then found an edition of a book by Nan Shepherd, is it The Living Mountain?
Oh, yes. Fantastic.
Introduced by Robert McFarlane. And in that introduction from McFarlane, I found this quote from Patrick Cavanagh, from his essay, The Parish and the Universe. It says, "To know fully even one field or one land is a lifetime's experience. In the world of poetic experience, it is depth that counts, not width. A gap in a hedge, a smooth rock surfacing a narrow lane, a view of a woody meadow, the stream at the junction of four small fields. These are as much as a man can fully experience." And out of that came this poem, and out of this poem, suddenly the rest of the book began to fall into place. So I believed I understood the land. I believed I understood the land once, long ago. A child running in his mother's footsteps, who gleaned the names of birds that burst from the hedgerow, who pulled up solid fronds of fern that leaned out into his path to be sawn and ploughshare, imagined toys that soiled his hands and greened the valley sunlight as he caught foxes unaware when they bolted home across the failing pastures spilled out below his house. I would not dare now to say I knew anything of land. It has no master, only people who strive to learn and understand the minutes of it and the hours. The earth moves faster than we can comprehend, so seek a segment, find a strand of it that you can love. Listen to the movement in one hedge, attune to it, see what it will give, make no demand. If you've listened, you'll know we're balanced on the edge between oblivion and life, and that the only charm for our salvation comes in the moments when we pledge to do no lasting damage, cause as little harm as we can manage in field or office, city street or farm." That's a very appropriate ringtone.
Yeah, sorry.
No, don't worry, it's fine.
I just completely forgot about it.
Don't worry. I wish it had been just a phone thing. It would have been perhaps a problem. But a barking dog just fitted right in. Don't worry.
A sheepdog trying to get in.
As I say, I went to these farms, slightly clumsy and unused to toil, poet type, and the farmers put me through my paces. The first farm I'm going to read a poem from is one in Malham, up in the Dales in Yorkshire. This is "You'll Find Your Way." There's steam rising from the road as we ride the quad bike up narrow lanes between fence-topped walls to the gate out onto Pike Door. I cling on hard, perched like a parrot behind Neil, the dogs racing us as we pass the erratic downward flow of tractors, hikers and tourists in polished cars. "You know the grass is growing when tarmac steams," shouts Neil over his shoulder. "It's warm and wet, the perfect time." We slide upward through moisture, rising to meet thin strips of white clawed across a seam of blue. I raise my face to watch the sun. Beyond the gate, the quad bike bucks and shifts on rough lanes between rocks like a circus bronco. I won't be thrown. Knuckles white against my plywood seat, I twist to the tune of Pike Door. A grim laugh bursts from my lips. "You're right," asks Neil. "You know, I'm the first farmer in a millennium not to farm this land on foot. I'm 2 stone heavier than my father was at the same age as me." At the peak, Neil points out a steep incline down through rocks. Farmhouse is down there. Follow the walls. You'll find your way. I did. It took me a while. In the same vein, the next farm I'm going to read from is Woodland Valley Farm in a village called Laddock, not far from Truro. There the farmer was practicing mob grazing. If you don't know what that is, this will, I think, explain some of it. Grass is a pump, a piston working through the earth, taking carbon from the air to sequester in the soil. The cattle work this pump for us each day as we fold them out across the field, following the line of the electric fence. No, they don't like the wire. Look how they butt each other at the humming edge, eager to reach new growth. There's always one or two who'll leap the moon and risk its voltage for fresh chicory, plantain, clover, a taste of yarrow or deep-rooted dock. It keeps them carving dock, iodine-rich, an antimicrobial just growing in the soil. It'll be 3 months or so before they're back here. This wasted patch will be in full flower again after 100 days. The parasites in their dung should have died off at last. We mimic nature as we move, an electric wire for a season's shift. It takes 2 days for pasture to be reduced to this. Give them a small area to boost their eating until, like Tantalus, they attempt to stretch their necks beyond fences. Look how they shift. They know the charge is dead. Hold that wire taut. It's time to move. I hold the wire. Skylarks sing high in the serrated blue. It takes a quarter of the day just to shift the fences, Chris says, before he moves off down the field, attaching wire to the teeth of plastic poles. I turn to my phone, check Facebook, new to this and bored of standing. The wire goes slack. Tighten up, Adam, or they'll escape. The call from the far corner of the field is carried in too late on a tensile breeze. One cow bounds over, then another, then one more before the wire is taut enough to put the others off. Ah, damn, says Chris as I hide my phone and he scrambles for his. Janet, three of them are off in the high pasture. We'll need the horse. Ashamed of my inattention, I put aside phones and photographs of sunlight on pasture, let go the poet's tendency to wander and hold the wire hard. I run my imagination through it as electricity, attempt to keep the remaining cattle bordered in by thought. Just hold it taut, calls Chris. Hold it taut and don't let go again. Here comes the cavalry of Janet, rising to the horse's trot as the hill eases away beneath them. The cattle shift into new positions, guarded as teenagers caught smoking out of their bedroom windows. As the cavalry of Janet sweeps round, outflanks the herd and, with a gentle whoop, halts all efforts to escape. The three who made it across the wire away into lush depths of calf-deep pasture are nowhere to be seen. Gone over the hill's crest into a wide blue of imagined forever clover. But the cavalry of Janet bolts off after them as I pull the wire taut and impenetrable, and plastic holding posts are plunged into position like hasty infantry. It takes mere minutes for the deserters to return glum-faced and sulky to the last gate left between hedge and electric fence, the cavalry of Janet riding triumphant in their wake, sun caught like a halo on her wide-brimmed hat. We shift at her command, take up our places, moving ourselves as the cattle move to block all avenues of retreat. The cavalry of Janet romps all deserters out of the wider pasture, and I run, flailing wire and arms to make a connection. The fence goes live, and cattle settle to its insect hum, turn their heads down to pasture rasp, slave to their tongues once more. As the cavalry of Janet waves her hat at us in benediction, trots off in a parade of one back down the hill to the quiet of the yard and home. Next farm, this is all from spring of 2016. Next place I'm going to read a poem from is not so far from here. One of the farms I visited was just outside Abergavenny, in a little village called Llanfethrin, not far from White Castle. And a lot of this process of visiting farms was learning about things. And I learned in different farms and in different landscapes, I learned very different things. For example, the farm in Llanfethrin had been rife with orph, a disease that affects the teats of sheep, but goats particularly. And they treated it with homeopathy, much to the merriment of their neighbours. After 18 years, they're the only farm in the area that only has the occasional bout of orph. And they also made a specialist interest in what goes on beneath the soil, so this is a poem more about that. It's called It Came to Us Compacted. The hayfield, bought at auction a decade back, bids pumped up by rivals with housing plans, was ploughed relentlessly throughout the war. It came to us compacted, full of docks, so we made hay of it, parked a gypsy caravan in the corner of the field and let the biosphere build. It's best, we found, to focus on the soil itself. Reduce inputs and let the field build up a city weight beneath the sward. Worms beneath a field full of healthy cows would, gathered up, weigh more than the cows themselves, says Nick. And plants feed many sugars to bacteria, are wedded to a fungus layer which spreads for miles, exchanges information, levels out the losses in a field. We don't just farm the top inch of the soil here. A plough tears as atomic fire tears, wholesale. Breaks up burrows it took 10 years for worms to build. Destroys the commuter routes of horizontal traveller worms. Smashes the symbiotic satellite networks of plant communication. They still lose a little topsoil here. This is Wales. Rain is ubiquitous. We walk the field. Its permanent crop built high beneath damp May sun. The turf's been slit to let more air and water in. In the caravan, a honeymooning couple pack away last flirtations, get ready for the steady growth of married life. A whisper of rain through trees. The soil does the same. Read one more from this. Is now heading into autumn before we brief chat. This is from the farm in Kent that I visited, which is in a little valley not far from Sevenoaks. That going there by train, you go through commuter belt, suburbia, tunnel, sudden shock of countryside. You can go up the hill out of the woods around this valley and see Canary Wharf 30 miles away. Vividly, but it's a valley that Samuel Palmer used to walk to paint. And I arrived there in April of 2016, the day after a cow had died, giving birth to a calf. This is somewhat to do with that. It's called Bloody Adam. The cattle won't leave the windfalls, however much fidelity calls. Her shouts goad Sam into a frenzy. He snaps at ankles, twice narrowly avoids a fecal crown, startles the calf-eyed bottle-fed last spring so much it bolts into a hedgerow cage of nettle, bramble, convolvulus and saplings arched for capture. Bloody Adam, says Matthew. I turn, as does the calf. At least he tries. Come on, Adam, you blasted thing. He taps the calf with a plastic hose. It shifts into deeper entanglement while I relax, relieved I'm not at fault. It takes 5 minutes with a knife to cut the awkward calf a path back out onto the hollow lane. Adam skips back to his adopted mother, crowned with tangled brash. Bloody Adam's dressed for Christmas. No apples left, except for muddy splatters of sour white flesh buried in the path. The herd accepts Matthew's call to move along. It's a good pace, the Hereford Stroll, says Matthew. Just fast enough in this unexpected mid-September heat. He moves ahead. Bloody Adam, I ask, catching Fidelity's eye. We named him after you, she says with a small laugh. And then, well, he misbehaved. A lot. I watch the calf slither on a muddy bank. Whisper Bloody Adam with a foolish pride.
Well, as you can see, it's such an entertaining read. It is a lovely journey to go on through these seasons. So I'd like to start by just asking you a bit about the residency and this whole process of being, you know, commissioned and living on these farms. I mean, there's a poem where you tell one of the farmers that you're vegetarian. There's all kinds of things that make you think you might have been slightly incongruous, and some of your poems were. So can you talk a bit about that and how you kind of settle yourself into that kind of role and how you...
Well, I mean... I was originally asked to do this by the chair of the Pastureford Livestock Association, who lives not far from me in the other side of Stroud. And I was in the midst of writing 1,000 Laurie Leaves and said, yeah, that sounds like a good idea. I'll happily write about farming at some point. Mm. And he came back and persisted and persisted. It turns out he also persisted with the farmers. I mean, Neil, the Yorkshireman, particularly said, poet? Really? And he had learned apparently long ago that John Meadley is not a person to be who will take no for an answer, and so he, in his own words, he said that he learned that the idea that a poet might be coming up meant could you meet him at Skipton Station week on Tuesday, please? And there was this certain amount. I mean, at the launch in January, some of the farmers spoke before the reading at the Oxford Real Farming Conference and launched. I'm the only poet to have launched a book at a farming conference, which is kind of funny. But they all said, oh, there's this big chap. He's vegetarian. At least he's not vegan. Will he be any use? Like I say here, I threw myself at it. And I think the thing that allowed me to be accepted was the fact that I turned up okay, with a head full of poetry, of farming, Virgil's Georgics, Wendell Berry, who I quote later on in the book, Ted Hughes. But I also turned up with a notebook and a camera and was quite prepared to listen and learn and throw myself at it, even if I completely screwed things up occasionally. in the Kent farm, I fell over a fence and they were kind of, I could see when I was getting up the farmer watching me to see if I made a fuss or started to cry or did poet things. And now I just, bugger, can I have a plaster, please? And that was it. It was fine. It was willingness to learn, particularly.
Yeah, well, I think that's interesting because one of the things that comes out in the book from the first poem which we heard, where you talk about that kind of child knowing or ways of being in nature, and then you've got the other kinds of knowing that are coming into the poems through talking with people and reading or photographs and I thought that's really interesting as a poet, all these different types of knowing and how we arrange ourselves with those when you're trying to write something like this, where I suppose you've got a sense of writing to something or an organisation or the people you're staying with, but also from yourself, and I'd be interested to...
They gave me quite a lot of freedom. They said, yeah, go. We want you to think about the relationship between man, animal, landscape. We want you to think about what pasture does, and kind of we will bombard you. They did bombard me with scientific fact about the soil and about the way pasture locks things in. Mm. As a vegetarian, I came away from it. Still determined not to be a vegetarian, I'm not going to eat meat, but less certain about the extreme moral arguments on either side for must only eat meat, must only eat tofu, whatever. And the need for balance, which kind of comes out quite strongly in the book later on.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, I think when you read the book, there is a really strong sense of a kind of building process happening through the book. And I was curious, I mean, I experienced it a bit in the sense of the way that things like balance are beginning in tentative ways, ideas that then sort of seem to really take on a force, and then and the kind of landscapes, the stones or the eyes of the animals. I mean, these things really have this kind of rhythmic thing that because they're coming up through the book. And so I was thinking how that worked, because you wrote the book through this process of staying in this farm. Is the book chronological, or and how does do you have that sense of how the book moved as you went through it?
Yes, I mean it is chronological. It follows the seasons, spring to autumn, because I missed the summer of 2016. There was too much going on, and I mean the whole Brexit referendum changed the way things were being thought about in the farming. Well, it made this more of an urgent thing. Whatever everyone's opinion about the result of the referendum, things suddenly shifted.
Right.
Went through. And I was writing notes and taking photographs, keeping a journal of it all. But I only started to really write the book in Easter of last year. Mm. I wrote a couple of poems before that at the Oxford Real Farming Conference and so on. Got the title of the book. And then it got to Easter and not enough poems had turned up, and the farmers were getting across, and the commissioning body was saying, come on, where is it? And I got dragged off to the chair of John Meadley's house and put in his summer house at the end of his garden and allowed to stay there for a week, and told that you write, come in the evening, we'll feed you, and then you'll read us what you've written.
No, right.
Nothing like a bit of incentive and pressure. And it worked, because then the book started to fall into place, because I'd just come back from the winter visit to Malham, and I wrote a very long poem about walking. I'm quite influenced by my mother, actually, that poem, in terms of, you know, the landscape particularly, and walking. But it kind of triggered something, and then I kind of got the idea that I'd started to pick up at the Oxford Real Farming Conference, where I was put in residence last year, using a collage. I mean, I've trained as a journalist, not trained as a journalist, I worked as a journalist for years. I worked on newspapers, on various, Sarah Jane actually got me doing stuff as a journalist in the Cheltenham Poetry Festival, Literature Festival years ago. And that practice, woven in, so the farmers' voices, blended with documentary fact, blended with poetic observation, I suddenly found myself, I mean, this was quite heavily edited at the time, but it came very quickly. And it all kind of fell into place over three sessions of read to us after you've eaten what you've written today.
Yeah. It does have a kind of pressure cooker feeling that, because you have winter and then you have the kind of final sort of section, which is a kind of how would you describe the final section?
Oh, it's a dive into the ethics and politics of farming.
It is,
and kind of looking forward.
Yeah, and yet because the conversations are always there throughout the book, that's really changes how you feel of it. Feel as you read it. So even there's one set in an abattoir, and you've got you sort of observing, but then this conversation that happens with the chap who's working there, and I feel somehow that really does affect how we read the book. So you always, there's this sort of flow, I suppose, a conversational flow maybe.
Once I realised how it was working, that was kind of I tried to achieve that.
Yeah.
I'm glad you think it has to some extent. But that particular poem, the abattoir poem, it was totally a pressure cooker moment, because I went, I'm, as I say, a vegetarian. I went to the abattoir not far from Stroud, where I live, not on a slaughter day, which is fortunate, but still shocking. And this it's a 7-part poem, and it starts very kind of viscerally in the abattoir, and goes off into, I mean, this is where Wendell Berry came in particularly. He's quoted in that poem, and listening to him on the radio as well last year when his book of essays came out, it's gone off into a kind of, that's one riffing off Berry and that the kind of philosophical approach to farming and food and all of that. It was written in a weekend, and I had to spend 3 days recovering from writing it.
Right, yes. I did feel that intensity of the experience. So there's a winter poem where you're walking and following, and it again uses this repetition very strongly with the stone and the wind. Mm. I mean, this is a book full of sounds as well. I mean, you're really hearing the sounds, I think, from that you must have heard. But and there's a sort of bleakness to the poem, but then you bring it back to the home, the farmhouse and the home. I wonder if you might say a bit about that and how that came as a poem.
Well, that's the first, I mean, this Walking the Bounds, it's called, and that was, as I said earlier, it was kind of, that was landscape, the sort of landscapes, if you know my mother's writing, Frances Horowitz's poems, she was very interested in stone, and I was up in the Yorkshire Dales and kind of thinking about that, and she walked a lot for inspiration. So I took off up Pike Door, up 1,800 feet above sea level, from the farm up and round, observing the landscape. And I came back with a little, one of those little moleskin notepads, 5 small pages with tightly scribbled notes, a few photographs, and a 250-line poem came out of it. Because it was a very, very vivid thing. Funnily enough, this is the first poem I sent to Neil, the Yorkshire farmer. I show you all these sheep, beautiful flocks. You show you these lovely living cattle. You send me a long poem about dead sheep. But it was the winter, and you know, it's a very necessary part of the process.
Of the process, yes. And there are these poems about the poem about drinking the raw milk for the first time. That's and has this kind of wonderful ecstatic.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
And the sunlight, and there's a lot of a kind of feeling about what you know, the how poetry is, that sort of thing between inspiration and what you're told, and how you can marry those things, I think, and the kind of romantic ideas and then reality and all these things. There's a sort of...
A lot of the farmers have expressed pleasure and relief that it is not a romantic book of poems about wandering.
Yeah.
Those wandering, it really does look at the... Try and look at the hard details there.
Yeah, that's it. There's a poem about cider making, which is very, you know, yeah.
Yeah.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, please.
It's fascinating, and thank you so much for what you're talking about. I've been reading a lot recently about unusual artists in residence kind of relationships. One of my favourite artists is a New York artist in she's still practicing, but she was an artist in residence in the 70s until the present day. In the New York Department of Sanitation, and she worked at Mill, Rodham and Newcomings. And so, this does relate to a question, so what's interested in is, obviously there's a kind of, there's a lot of humbleness in what you're saying, but you know, you're learning from the farmers, and there's so much they're teaching you, and there's also that element of mucking in and having to, like, you know, sort of suppress poetly instincts to let the fence drop in, and kind of just, I wondered what the farmers... How the farmers kind of responded and what they learned from you and
your practice? Well, I mean, one of them said, Neil from Yorkshire, said at the thing, which was, I mean, extremely flattering thing for him to say, that he'd learned more he'd learned more from me going for 48 hours to his farm than he'd learned from about certain things anyway, in 48 years of living on and working on that farm. Because it was a different angle, so they were. They. I mean, this was the point of it, was to bring This is what I picked up at the Oxford Real Farming Conference, because I went and did, I wrote two poems there, one the title poem of the book, and it is a collage of phrases and ideas picked up that then I spun back and gave back to them. And that was the aim, was to try and kind of clarify, this with poetry in general, it's to try and clarify things in some respect.
And because I think there's a tendency, isn't there, to sort of feel a bit apologetic about one's practice as an artist compared with the labour, the kind of honest labour of the countryside. But it's really lovely when they perceive that, you know, that one's own labour is perceived as honest.
If I'd just floated off up the hill and come back for supper, that would have been a problem. I did muck in, which helped. That was a surprise to me, because I have been, I mean, tell them I'm not the most active of people. I'm getting better. But it's been a revelation that, I mean, I've written more and better as a consequence of going out and getting some exercise than I have in a long time.
Can I just extend that question about the point of it? Because from the pasture, the Pasture Association, were they looking at this as a sort of celebration of what they did, or is it a cunning marketing tool in some way?
There's a little bit of that, yeah. I mean, the guy who commissioned him, John Meadley, is delightedly going around saying, here, look, this is what we do, and it's come in other ways. But it's not cunning. I think it is a little bit of a marketing tool, but it's a celebration too. He's pleased with it. They did give me a lot of freedom. Mm-hmm. I mean, the arguments about vegetarianism throughout are not necessarily going to sit that well with some of the farmers.
But it didn't come a point in saying we don't want this poem because
No. I mean, Camilla, my publisher, just sat there, got things straight. They were read to John and his wife after supper when I'd written them. I edited them, I sent them off. And there was no...
And I jumped up and down with excitement.
There was no censorship whatsoever. And, there are some things that aren't so easy, I think, for them to hear, but that helps.
I think John and a number of people who know him are trying hard to say, we could do things differently on the farms. Mm. There are people doing it, let's listen to them, let's find out what they think and see if there's a value here. And it comes across so strongly in what you've written. It's really interesting.
Yeah, I love that image. I still, it's very, very redolent of the soil almost being married to its custodian, and together they grow. I think it's just such a beautiful image. And immediately then, I think I'll go out and look at soil completely differently and just look at what's going on under the surface. And yes, carrying on from that really fantastic question, whether you think you've helped the farmers see things differently. I think you've already answered it.
They gave me the scientific facts. And the first farm I went to, in fact, was one in Cornwall. And I was marched out into the field, and he took one of those scoop trowels. Look how this looks. Mm-hmm. Compare it to this field. We went to a neighbour's field, which was not mob-grazed, pasture-fed, had a whole load of panels in it. He sneakily took a bit of that, and it was a very different soil, just three fields away. Mm. I mean, I was learning from them. They learned some from me, but I think it's just that kind of that hint of the romantic view of the land.
Has it changed how you relate to the land now when you walk in it, having gone through this process?
I know more about what's going on.
So
I
when can... you're walking, are you taking that with you now?
Yes. Yeah.
So you get a deeper understanding.
Yeah. It's been very rewarding for me. I hope it's been rewarding for the farmers. So.
And I'm curious about, does anyone mind if I ask about the Brexit thing that happened in the middle of the book and how things shifted amongst the people you were? Because you mentioned there was a sort of...
There was some of the farmers I visited were pro-Brexit, some were really not.
Okay, so
and it was interesting. I mean, what I did was I spent the I found myself kind of one of the good things for the book itself was the fact that I had to rein in my opinion, which doesn't matter what that is, about Brexit, and just listen to them.
Mm.
And again, that feeds back into the theme of balance that comes up in the book.
Mm.
So. Mm. And it suddenly everything shifted. The real focus was on how are we going to maintain this soil health, this approach.
Mm. I mean, and for me as a reader, you know, reading the poems, I felt like there was this feeling of the work of a farmer and the work of a poet, you know, as having these lovely. I feel like that. I don't know if that was an aim of the book to talk about the craft of poetry and the cycle of poetry and the sort of idea of the soil of the what's inside and how that's nurtured. Or that was a thing I enjoyed about it. So maybe
I'm not sure I noticed.
Yeah, well, it's.
I mean, there's a line in here that says, "We are born of compost. So all of us are, to some extent." So.
Yeah. Well, we'll have some poems to finish, and then if you do have any final questions, maybe there'll be time. But Adam will also be signing books, and there is a lovely selection of books, so you can chat with him up. So thank you, Adam, for the interesting chat, and we'll hear some poems.
I'll read a couple from Winter. I only managed to visit two farms during the winter, the one in Kent and the one in Yorkshire. The first is from Underriver in Kent, Spoils. Cattle come running to the hum of the quad bike, the promise of hay sweeter than this tired winter grass. Here at the top of the field, in the cold rise above the farm, where the wind sits heavy on the sun's shine, grass grips close to soil. Brambles flail over the fence lip, cones of bracken are pressed into oblivion by eager hooves. We have lured the bullocks here away from the softer curves of the farm's lower reaches. The hay hurled from the trailer is a bribe for their trampling, a tribute. No weed killer here. The land fulfills itself under the pressure of hooves. Despite the old spaniel with a mucky eye keen to guard the bracken, barking and feinting rash challenges to the cows as they rip hay apart with limber tongues, test their nascent horns brother on brother in glass-eyed hunger games. Today, they are grass-starved demigods, these bullocks, manoeuvred and conditioned by greed into keeping down stray weeds. All that spoils the pasture corrupts the soil. I'll read two sections from the long poem Clay mentioned, Walking the Bounds from Yorkshire. Give an idea of it. The first is part 10 of the poem, which is right at the top of the hill. Balanced on the giddy edge of the hill, I watch the sweep of walls shadow the swell of dales, surrounded by cautious, disinterested cattle as they consummate their endless, regurgitated relationship with herbs and grass. Sheep startle at my slightest movement, like children balanced in a vast playground expecting an endless game of tag. Balanced. Acre upon acre of grassland interwoven with herbs and clovers, the land bound tight into itself to hold the soil. Carbon presses upward, carrying the weight of growth as pipe door settles into the insectile overtures of spring, and calves stand to attention while time shifts up a gear, and a tractor grinds gnat-like on a distant lane. Balanced between wildlife and the need for food. In the farm kitchen, I shake off rain, hang traces of the day on a busy hook,
The old sheepdog tilts its head at me, begs for scraps of scent as I sit and scratch between the twin stars of its eyes, one blue, one brown, as different and as close together as Pike Door and the wandering sky. I am unsettled within doors. The light is still and unbending. I carry the memory of death in my mouth. The sheep's number stings under my tongue. Lee boils the kettle, offers tea into normality as her daughter laughs in the other room, roots through imaginary landscapes where everything is living and cannot die. Neil opens the door, brings in a bolt of winter with a laugh. A good walk, he asks, casting the contents of his pockets on the table like bones. I saw a dead sheep by the hay barn, a crow sipping at its eye. He stops, looks sad for a moment. Ah, he says, I wondered if she'd make it through to Lammy. Did you see her sister under blue plastic? I kept them round in hope they'd see it through. They were old. It's hard living up on Pike Door. I open my iPad to find him the number of the U, swipe my fingers over blood-specked wool. A coldness settles in me. Not sorrow as such, more my veins rebuilt as walls, learning the need for stone. One from Laddock and Cornwall. And the farm there had turned, when I started visiting, there was still a beef farm, and they decided to shift to dairy. So this is... this poem is about the milking parlour and the first products. So it was there not long after they started milking. It's called Raw Milk. Milk, 10 minutes fresh from the udder, spun like candy floss at the bucket's rim. Colm thrusts a cup below the crust of cream. Have you tasted milk this raw before? It melts on my tongue, sweet. Warm. I suck at the cup till all but a ghostly filament of froth is gone. I'm going to finish with a couple of poems from the last section. First is the first section of the poem about the abattoir. And the last two lines of this are a direct quote from Wendell Berry's poem, Rising. And here is where the intelligence of grass is harvested. Here in pale, clean rooms, lined with jaws of metal that smell of bleach, confusion. A little man with old eyes leans on concrete, talks of pelt pullers, the consistencies of fat preserved by stripping hides from bottom to top. Here in the hard truth room that runs unsteady underfoot with channels cut to ferry blood. Vegetarian, he says. What the dickens brought you here? I've come to see if I can understand, I want to say. Instead, I listen and, almost mute, enter the exhibition room where marbled sculptures hang in cold companionship. Like distorted globes, they're marked, all 14 with archipelagos of flesh and fat. No weak pink plastic packages these lay like fancy bricks on supermarket shelves, but engines stripped of their facade, evolved to turn grasses, herbs and flowers into weight. Here is the truth laid out in a sticky braille of ribs. The dead become the intelligence of life. Where the tree falls, the forest rises. This poem deals, I suppose, with the politics we were discussing earlier, political situation head on. It's called The Farm Faces Forward. The farm faces forward. Practicalities are observed and acted upon. If it's easier to sell butter by the kilo than to push the same weight of meat, then in comes the dairy herd and things shift accordingly. The scales balance. Everything's an experiment in these discordant, Brexit-weighted times. The world seems stranger than it's ever been on the surface. It moves so fast that soil is an irrelevance in certain circles, unworthy of complicated thought. Balance out of whack, shouted down on all sides as fear sweeps through the halls where power festers in unoxygenated compost, where the worms have turned on each other and nothing breathes that does not breathe fire or money. It will keep on doing so till balance returns to books and brains and hearts, until the quiet, relentless industry of soil is recognized again for its ability to take everything that seems separate and opposed and unify it under the surface of the land, this land, all land, any land. You cannot buy balance. It is only ever earned in the fertile scrum of living together in each alchemical moment, forging futures from the rot of shared history. A farm faces forward, spreads the muck of living out in fertile handfuls. The pasture is a place of beginnings as much as endings. Balance in the hayfield, in high city towers, balance in fungal layers, in a cow's digestive tract. Balance. The ladder shifts as you climb it, with no wall to rest against. Balance in the dairy, in the bank, in crumbs of soil, in the steady pulse of everything that lives. The soil never sleeps. In its voids, gas and waters gather, waiting for thirsty roots to crawl down motorway tunnels dug by worms. The spade, the plough, the massage press of hooves, for the rain to run through its seams and seeds to push up to the light. The soil never sleeps. It banks lives in its souffle stomach, connects them to everything. Even the dirt beneath fingernails, the dirt caught in a mole's coat, sings with a million microbes to the gram of connections, growth. The soil never sleeps, never slips into ideology or nostalgia. It is place and purpose, the perfection of decay, a story that shifts from mouth to mouth, a crucible for rebirth, a rooftop on another world. Thank you.